2 Timothy 1:7, for God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and a sound mind. Those are great things to be reminded of, aren't they? Amidst all the chaos, all the turmoil, we're reminded once again that our faith, our trust, is not found in human hands or human rule. Our faith and our trust is found in the arms of Christ. Someone asked me last week after the worship service, they came up to me and said, "Pastor," they looked really serious. So when that happens, all kinds of things can come about. "Pastor, are we in trouble financially?" I was kind of taken back by that. Last week we started a series on bold thanksgiving, so a series on giving and giving of finances, and she just asked, are we in trouble financially? And I said, "Well, why would you ask that?" She said, "Well, because most of the time when I ever hear pastors preach sermons on money, it's because the church is desperate and financially in trouble and we have to bail you out." And I said, "No, we're not in trouble, and you certainly don't have to bail me out. But I do have a convertible in the back parking lot that needs a new transmission." No, I didn't say that. I did not say that. But it was interesting because, once again, if you think, remember last week we talked about the perception of church and finances and money and giving. And so often people have just such a distorted view of that. And so as we get in, as we begin and looking again and dealing with money and finances, we ended last week with just the simple thought and the reality of that everything is God's anyway. It's all His. So imagine this, and imagine if we held nothing back. Imagine if we were to place everything in God's hands because they are His anyway. A radical perspective change would take place in our lives. We would see everything around us as it actually belongs to God. So this morning, you left God's house in God's clothes. Some of you with God's children, although for others, you probably thought they were fallen angels. But you drove here in God's car. You walked into another of God's house. You're sitting down next to God's spouse or God's friends, or some of you would probably like to give them back to God, but that's not the point. And you're sitting next to God's family. You're sitting next to 90% of you decided what to do with God's money before you even left the house this morning. Imagine if everything were in our thought process, it's all God's anyway. I'm not sure there's a more difficult time as a pastor or leader, and some of you who are and have been know this, than sitting down with a family who has lost a loved one. Maybe even more so, parents who have lost a child. Jim and Linda, Friday afternoon at the funeral home, were adamant that Jordan's funeral must be a celebration of the life he lived. And their exact words, a celebration of the 23 years that God gave him to us. That's incredible ownership, isn't it? We're caretakers. Everything is His. He owns it all. The Apostle Paul in Colossians chapter 1, he wrote this: "For by Him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by Him and for Him." He is, talking about Jesus Christ, He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. When Paul was talking to those on Mars Hill in Athens, and he was talking to a secular group of people who had erected an idol to an unknown God, and Paul took advantage and walked up to them and said, "Hey, that unknown God you're talking about, I can tell you about Him. I can tell you what you need to know, that so he's no longer an unknown God, that you're kind of covering all of your bases and making sure that you've got all the gods covered. Here he is, and this is what he said. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. The most basic principle of giving we found last week is simply this. Am I living and enjoying my life to glorify God, or am I living and elevating myself, someone else, or something else above and over God himself? And these two passages we just read describe the futility of doing that. God owns it all. The passage we want to continue to look at is in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And we want to begin reading in verse 11. I believe in your pew Bible is page 1079. 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And we want to look at the 12 verses. We started this last week, but we want to look at this and give a little bit deeper context to it. And as we read through some of this, I'm not going to read through everything word for word, but I'm going to put up on the PowerPoint some phrases and words that I want you to begin to look at and to identify the area of bold giving. I want you to see the powerful and the bold statements that Paul is making here when he identifies this Corinthian church. Now, remember, this is the second book written to them. This was considered perhaps the most dysfunctional church of all the ones that Paul ministered and served. The first book was basically a book of correction, a book of challenge, a book of, look, you need to get your act together. You're a church that represents Christ in a Roman foreign government. You need to figure out how to do this. The second book comes along and begins to give them a little bit more depth and substance, because Paul recognizes the church is truly Corinth making a change. So the second book begins to give some practical aspects. You begin to turn the church around. Here's some things to do. Chapter 1 of 2 Corinthians talks about that God of all comfort who comforts us in all our struggles and tribulations, so that we might be able to comfort others who have gone through the same thing. I cannot sit down with Jim and Linda and tell them what it feels like to lose a child. I can't. But some of you in here have. And you know the depth of what that means. It's interesting, Paul talks about that right away in this book of 2 Corinthians, about the ability of the God of all comfort who comforts us in our troubles. Why? So that we can serve and minister others. Is that reflection of our investment, the fact that when he tells us that no one member of the body suffers without all of us suffering. We all do. When one rejoices, we all rejoice. No member says to the other, I don't need you. That was his challenge in the first book, because there was a lot of divisions and a lot of splits and a lot of confusion and a lot of chaos, much like the world we live in today. Regardless of a political election or not, there is massive disunity, massive chaos. And Paul looks to the church and says to the church, within the church, you cannot have that fracturing. You cannot have that division. You must display the unity in the bond of peace. In our country today, we need to pray for that peace, don't we? We need to pray for our leadership. Regardless of what your vote was Tuesday, the Word of God commands us to pray for the leadership that is in authority over us. We need to pray for leadership that is willing to come together and say, you know what? This country struggles. How are we going to bring this country somewhat back together again? We need leadership that's willing to do that. That's what, as a church, we pray for that leadership. But ultimately, we know that the only peace that brings together a divide is found in the person of Jesus Christ. And so we ask ourselves as a church, how do we demonstrate that unity? How do we demonstrate that love? Interestingly enough, one of the best phrases that I heard all week long about the political tension and climate was from a sportscaster, Ernie Johnson, a devout Christian who has no fear of sharing his faith in various ways and means. And he basically said that every one of us should have hope that things can be better, But every one of us needs to look at ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves, how am I going to be a better person to my neighbor? How am I going to be a better person in life to those around me? How am I going to make a difference around me? And as Christians, we ask ourselves, how am I going to be a better Christ that the world sees? How am I going to be a better light that the world sees? How am I going to be a better hope to the hopeless? We're going to end our worship service with the song Rooftops. Standing on the roof, looking around, where you stand determines what you see. If you're only standing in your closet at home, that's all you'll see. But the challenge is, how will we reflect? Ernie Johnson went on and he said this, and I love this. He said, we need to be a fountain rather than a drain. Who knew sportscasters came up with good stuff? Isn't that amazing? We need to be a fountain. And he's talking about a fountain of the King and the Lord we serve rather than a drain. You put that in an application. That's what Paul was challenging this church, because this church was horribly divided. But he gets now into the second book, and he now begins to work through some areas that are very critical for church health. There are significant areas of discipline that he worked through in the first book that are now coming to fruition here in the second book. The challenge in the second book is, we are told we are ambassadors of Christ. We represent a heavenly citizenship here on earth. And because of that, we know who we are. And so he begins to go into that. We're ministers of reconciliation. We are to describe, to defend, and to show the fact that between God and man, Jesus Christ is that mediator, and that reconciling factor, that two can be brought together. We are part of that mediating step because we know who is the mediator, Jesus Christ. And so Paul challenges that church. And now in chapter 8 and 9, he gets into the area of finances and a very direct aspect. So follow along in chapter 8 as we look on this and as we see some of these words and these power phrases that he talks about. Verse 2, out of the most severe trial, their overwhelming joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. I testify, they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability, entirely on their own. Isn't it amazing when you come home or something happens and your children or your spouse or a friend or somebody has done something entirely on their own that you did not expect, like clean their room? I'm going to tell you this, and here's a commitment from the pulpit. There will come a day where you will walk into my office. This side of heaven, by the way, and you will be shocked because it will look exactly like Kathy Sweet's desk. Perfect. There will come a day. Now, that's all I'm going to say, okay? And that one day, who knows? But it will come a day. You'll be shocked. You say, he really did it. It works. But that's what Paul's talking about, entirely on their own. They saw the need and they said, you know what? We have to make a change. We have to do something. We look at our world today, and as a church, we need to say, we have to do something. What is it, God, that you want us right here in Byron Center to do in our community, to the global outreach? What do we have to do? Do we see that need? Do we respond with that? And Paul said, look, church, I got done ripping you big time in the first book, and now on your own, you're looking and you're saying, wow. You're urgently pleading with us for the privilege of serving. Then he goes on in verse 7, but just as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in your love for us, see that you also excel in this grace of giving. It's the only time Paul uses this kind of terminology, excel in this grace of giving. Verse 11, now finish the work, so your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion according to your means. Basically, put your money where your mouth is. That's really what he's saying. You have all this excitement, you have all this enthusiasm, you have all this energy. Okay, match it by what you give. Invest into this great calling this earnestness, invest into that, match it with what you're giving. And he goes on, he says, according to your means. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what he does not have. So Paul's pretty adamant about this. This is the spiritual discipline, the grace of giving. So what basically does this passage give to us then in bold giving? On the back of your bulletins, you'll have kind of an outline, and we'll fill this in looking at this. What does bold giving give to us? What this passage is talking about is that bold giving gives to us, number one, it changes other people's lives. Bold giving changes other people's lives. Paul is talking about a church that is investing into his ministry, that's investing into other churches, that's investing into a global outreach. Paul's talking about a church that looked outside of itself and said, God, we're here. What do you want us to do? That, by the way, is how this church moved from the city of Wyoming to this location. Because the pastoral staff, the board, and the elders said, okay, God, what do you want us to do? That's how this church came here. We continually ask that question. We're here, God. What do you want us to do? And so when we talk about bold giving changes other people's lives. In 2 weeks, you get to have an opportunity to see one of those areas of life changes, and that's our Drop Zone After School program. You get to take a chance to go on a tour. And by the way, you don't want to miss not just that tour at 11:30, you don't want to miss that Sunday morning worship service either. Slightly different. Just throwing it out there so you make sure you're here. Some of you will be a bit bloated after Thanksgiving. It doesn't matter. Show up anyway. Sit in the balcony. No one will know. But we balconies, people, every once in a while, you guys can come down too. But the reality of that is we have an opportunity to be able to do that. You can go and you can see a Drop Zone program. You can see how does it function. And you can actually see, you know what, we hear a lot about this. This is one of our outreach ministries. We have a number of other ones, but I want to see how it actually works. Well, then you're able to see the impact on other people's lives. The second thing that bold giving does is that bold giving basically, because of changing other people's lives, bold giving changes our lives. It changes our lives. When we're invested, when we're giving, when we're looking at how best I can get out of myself into the life and the ministry of others, it changes our lives. Now, obviously, as we see it change other people's lives, it's a challenge, excuse me, for us, but it looks at ourselves and we begin to reflect, how does it change my life? Monday morning, I got a text from a young family in this church. This family said, Pastor John, as a family, we started a tradition last year. We want to adopt a family for the holidays. Do you know of a family in need? Do you know of somebody? The text went on and said, we don't know how many, we don't know everything, but we want to do this. Can you help us? Changing our lives. What else is bold giving? Bold giving, number three, it opens doors to unique joy and blessings. We're going to talk about that next week a little bit more. Because we want to make sure we understand that giving is not a prosperity gospel. Because there is so much blatant scriptural abuse, manipulative tools used in the church today that has significantly thwarted the work of God's Spirit because of this area of giving. We want to talk about that. But when we talk about the reality of it opens doors to unique joy and blessings, even though we will say, and even though the scriptures are clear, it is not prosperity gospel, there is a prosperity in the gospel. There is a prosperity in the giving. There is a unique joy and blessing in the giving that you cannot get any other way. That is scriptural, that's biblical, that's why Paul was saying to them, look, you give according to what you have. Because every single one of you can do this. And every single one of you in giving what you have, you're able to find a blessing and a joy. So we want to look at that. The fourth thing is that it brings us closer to God's heart of generosity. It brings us closer to God's heart of generosity. Look again at verse 2. In verse 2, three phrases stand out. Out of the most severe trial, overflowing joy and extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. It's the attitude of whatever it takes to be part of God's plan, no matter what it is. A big part, a small part, does not matter. Whatever it takes, I'm willing to be a part of that. I'm willing to look at my attitude. And it all starts in our heart. It's like little Billy Scott, who was trying out for a school play, horrified and terrified that he might not get the part. Working hard, diligently, spent time with his mom, just working on that. The day came for the auditions. And little Billy went. Mom's at home, anxiously awaiting. Sure enough, little Billy jumps off the bus, couldn't wait to get in the house, bursts open the doors, and screams out, "Mom, Mom, I got the part!" Was it the lead part? Was it the major part? The mom, "What is it?" "Billy, I got chosen to clap and cheer." What part is that? That's what most of us would say. He's going to stand out to the side and clap and cheer, but he knew the value. He got the part. Whatever the part was, he's excited and he's thrilled about it. You see, that's what Paul's talking about here in this book. Whatever part you have, you need to be committed to do that. Whatever part it is, in rich generosity for what you have, that's the part you need to play. And so there's a sense here, there's a sense of alliance and reliance on what God has. Extreme poverty. You know, there's on the website, you can go, and there's a website called the Global Rich List. Now, I really debated over this. I seriously struggle with this somewhat because it can be so manipulative. We can sit in what would arguably be called the greatest country in the world, the wealthiest country in the world, the most benevolent country in world history. We can say all of those types of arguments. But when we put up something like this, it kind of makes us cringe and shrink and get all kinds of guilt. And we're so, I don't want to create that. But what I do want us to see is that in this country, we have no idea of extreme poverty. We don't. And because of Paul's talking to them, I want to at least show you and give you a comparison and try to understand the reality. On this global rich list, it kind of gives to us and identifies some things that you can see right up in here. It takes your average salary. You can punch in your average salary, and then you can compare it to the rest of the world. So, for example, if you made $58,000 this year, you made more than 99.8% of the world's population. And then it just moves down. If you made $40,000, you're in the upper 0.6%. If you made $20,000, you're in the upper 4% of the world's population. 34% of the world today lives on $2 a day. Most of you have that in change in your car, and you don't even know what's there. 84% of the world's population makes less than $20,000 a year. Now, I had to have something positive for this massive despair. The good news is almost everybody in the world has a cell phone, which actually is not too far from the truth. I think the latest statistics, there's almost 7.8 billion cell phones in the world today. What is this designed to do? It's not designed to make us cringe and be guilty. What it is to simply point out the fact that we are rich. We are rich beyond our understanding. We are rich beyond comprehension. And a lot of that richness, a lot of that opportunity, simply is because we were born here. We were born here. I took a trip with my daughter Joey's 10th grade class to Mexico, and we went to an orphanage. Now, this orphanage, where the kids were pretty well taken care of, but the reality of it is when they turn 16, they're kicked out. They're kicked out. Whether they have anywhere to go or not, they are kicked out. They have to leave. Some of those older kids that we talked to were dreading the fact that they were only a year away from being 16. They had no idea where they were going to go. They had no family. They had nothing. And yet when they turned 16, according to that law in that area, they had to leave that home. They had to leave that safe confines and go into the world. You see, the truth of the matter is, when we look at extreme poverty, we're rich. And Paul's not writing this passage to create this massive guilt, because unfortunately, too often, we give by guilt. What he is doing is he's saying, look, appreciate, value what you have, but don't value it more than what's God's. And if everything is God's, then that's the value statement we make. It's just the idea of reading to that guilt trip and be able to work through that. Jeff Surratt, he's a pastor at Saddleback Church. He said this about generosity. He said that generosity, and in looking at that, the generosity is the key to the treasure chest of joy. When I give, I experience just a taste of heaven. You see, this is the reality. This is what Paul is beginning to frame here as we move into chapter 9 in the next 2 weeks, as he's beginning to frame that giving is worship. Giving is a level of worship. It's really about worship. It's about experiencing God. It's about going out and giving of yourself beyond what you're able to do. And in that, you are worshiping God and you gain back. I would say almost every time when I visited around the country working at Grace Bible College, most of the students that I had previous, the things they would talk about were service trips, projects, things they did in Christian ministry, things that they were actively involved in giving and serving. The fundraising projects they would do for community awareness, whatever it was. Very rarely did I have a student sit down and say, John, on November 6th, I remember in class when you were lecturing on prayer, and I really appreciated that point. I never got that. Or a particular chapel service might have stimulated, but it was about how am I actively involved in giving of myself. Some of you may have that same kind of experience when you think back of what you've done and how you've been involved and the joy. It's worship. And spiritual warfare knows that. Satan knows that. Because the reality is that every single one of us as human beings, we are worshipers. Every one of us worship something or someone. It's not just religious, not just spiritual people. Every human being created by God is a worshiper, because that's why we were created, to worship him. And no matter that sin entered into the world and so death passed upon all men does not take away that void that we are to worship. And the only question is who or what or how? John Piper wrote and he said, be careful how you think, because how you think is what we will worship. Whatever you desire most is your God. That's what Paul is challenging this church with. In the first book, they desired a lot of things. They desired and had a lot of problems with the earthly things that were surrounding. They lived in one of the most corrupt cities of the known world at that time. Everything was just being pounded on them, and they were struggling with being a light in a darkness. They were the darkness. They were overwhelmed. And this whole idea of whatever they worship, that was their God, that's what Paul is challenging this. And he's telling them to remove and to begin to rethink this and to look at a different way. And how is it? So on your handout, you look on the back, you see number one, there's three questions there. How do we do this? The first question is simply, is it consistent? Is giving consistent? Is giving consistent? Does it come from a realization that God owns everything and I'm investing into what he owns because he gave it to me? Is it consistent? The second thing is just what we said. The second thing we ask ourselves in giving is it worship? Is it worship? Now in chapter 9, Paul says that God, he looks on our heart and he doesn't want us to give because we have to. Begrudgingly is the word out of the King James. And I can't tell you how many times, how many people find that a relief. That's basically an excuse. Well, if I can't give happily, then God doesn't want my money. Because he said, don't give because you have to. Ah, boy. I kind of feel like I have to, so whew, I'm off that one. No, that's not what it means at all. And we'll see that next week. But the second thing is relating to, is it worship? Is it worship in how we express? Is it worship in what we're doing? Is it worship in how we express a principle of who God is and how we give in response to Him? The principle in giving that we end with this morning is that the idea of giving from the heart, even under the law. Even under the law in the Old Testament, where the word tithing comes from, or a tenth part, even under the law, there was voluntary giving. Even under the law, there was the investment of families into giving. When they were rebuilding the temple in 1 Chronicles, it says the people rejoiced at the willing response of their leaders, for they had given freely and wholeheartedly to the Lord. And the leadership there wasn't just the hierarchy of government or of religious leaders, it was the family leadership. The families were working together and describing, what is it that we can give and how can we invest and what can we do? It's that family that texts and says, we want to adopt a family that has nothing and we want to be able to give to them. And that's what that idea is. It's giving from the heart. And so the family and the relationship of the family and how we instill giving into the hearts and minds of children. It's like the grandma who collected the Susan B. Anthony dollar coins. And she decided to give two of them to Adam on the way to church. And one of them was for the offering and the other one was for McDonald's ice cream special after church. So Adam is walking across the sidewalk to the church and all of a sudden he's flipping both coins at the air at the same time. One of the coins fell on the ground and rolled into the gutter. Spiritual Adam bowed his head, prayed to God, "Dear God, I'm sorry, your dollar is gone." You see, it all starts in the heart. It's all about the heart. It's all about where we're at. Jesus said in another passage of Scripture in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus says, "For where your treasure is, so is your heart." What do you value most? What is ultimately revealed in how your treasure is spent? Where is your heart? See, that's what Jesus is talking about. Where your treasure is, what you invest in, what you really want, that's where your heart's going to be. And out of your heart, the wellspring of life, the heart is the center of everything, Kyle Eidelman tells us. And that's why the gods fight so fiercely over it. And the third question we answer, is it joyful? Is it consistent? Is it worship? Is it joyful? In his book, Attributes of God, A.W. Tozier was asked the question, why aren't Christians the happiest, most relaxed people in the world? You say you have Jesus Christ. You say you have peace. You say you know eternity. Why are Christians not the most happiest, relaxed, joyful people in the world? And this is what he said. He said, because we seek to have our trust in things that are so little. Because we seek to have our trust in things that are so little. And so because of our faith as Christians, we need to attach God to those things. So I think I put up here on the back bottom part of your bulletin, you can do this. Draw a line, plus sign, and put God next to it. Because this is what we do. We put our confidence in things and God. We have our job and God. We have our family and God. We go to school and God. We live in a country and God. You see, what happens is we put "and God" after that line. We put whatever it is in that line, and you put whatever it is there that you right now you're looking at and say, boy, that's really true, because I say this, and I say, and God. And God's kind of an attachment, because I have to have him as attachment, because I'm a Christian. And because I'm a Christian, I'm supposed to show this. So there needs to be something there that God wants to attach. So if that's the case, then okay. But see, what Paul's talking about is he's talking about, in verse 7 of chapter 8, to excel in the grace of giving. Joyful. I heard it said, instead of asking ourselves, how much should I give? Someone once said we should ask the question, how much should I keep? That's a better question to ask. The truth of the matter is, and as we look at next week, we find that Jesus Christ is a giver himself. bold giving begins in your heart. And bold giving with the offering that you have begins with looking in your life and saying, what is that plus God that I've got to deal with? And you need to fill that in. Because it always isn't just money. One of the most profound stories I read in preparing for this was from James Emery White, pastor at Mecklenburg Church in North Carolina. He had just got done with a series of giving, preaching. And he said a lady came to his church office on a Thursday afternoon with a brown paper bag. She was going to just put it in the offering plate, this brown bag, but instead gave it to him instead. On the outside it read, Jim White. Underneath it, it said, be careful, sharp objects inside for the offering. She said to him, I thought I was going to put it in the offering plate, but I thought I wanted to give it to you directly. He opened up the brown paper bag, and inside were a bunch of razor blades. And then he read this note. I've been coming to your church on and off now since I was in fifth grade. I'm now 23. When I was 12 years old, I started cutting myself. Now my arms are covered in an overwhelming amount of scars. But I'm proud to say there are no open cuts. I've not cut for probably a year now. But I still have razor blades that are hidden around my room. I quit when I was about to cut one day, but I heard Jesus in my ear saying, I bled enough. She wrote, he took my pain on the cross, and I no longer needed to take it out of myself. She said, but I realized by holding on to the razor blades, I'm not fully letting go of the pain and the addiction to cutting. I want to fully let it go now. This is my offering. This is my first fruits of my heart, the very thing that was oppressing me, that didn't allow me the freedom to move into bold giving. You know, the Bible says, cast all your care on him, for he cares for you. That was her offering. What's yours? What's in that line, plus God? Because until you get to that and deal with that, you can never get to anywhere else in a fullest, richest sense.